The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt live back inside the Beltway on this Tuesday. Good morning to you. Much news. It is voting day in Ohio. The polls are open. It is a dead heat between State Senator Matt Dolan, businessman Bernie Marino, and current Secretary of State Frank LaRose. I really have no idea who's going to win this. Matt Dolan has been endorsed by Governor DeWine and Senator Rob Portman, who will be joining me later in the program. Donald Trump endorsed Bernie Marino, and J.D. Vance did as well. J.D. Vance was on yesterday. Frank LaRose has won statewide twice. It's really quite... All three of them can beat Sherrod Brown, so we will follow that with interest, and I don't think that they're going to be able to call that one all that early tonight, probably be tomorrow morning. Big story yesterday is Jake Sullivan goes to the press room and undercuts Israel in an extraordinary way. I have two columns on this today, one over at Fox News, the subtitle of which is All Wars Kill Innocents. The people who start them bear the blame, not the people who finish them. But Israel is getting blamed for the deaths in Gaza of everyone. And we don't even know how many people are being killed in Gaza because it all depends upon Hamas telling us. And we don't know. You can't believe anything that Hamas tells you. There is not a great deal of optimism about the hostage talks, which opened again last night in Doha. And it seems to me extraordinary that Jake Sullivan would say things like this. Cut number, where is Jake on my sheet? Cut number five.
Well, first of all, inherent in the question is a kind of an interesting irony, which is you have the prime minister speaking on American television about his concerns about Americans interfering in Israeli politics, and then your question is, should Americans be speaking into Israeli politics, which, in fact, we don't do nearly as much as they speak into ours.
All right. So that's not true. That's simply not true. Everyone in America is always speaking into Israeli politics. They just ignore us, as is their right. However, Israel does not speak into American politics. Anyone want to point me to other than a negative intervention in every round against Netanyahu by Obama, Biden less so, but the team Obama hated Netanyahu because he wouldn't be pushed around. He didn't like Iran. And he knew that Iran was full of fanatics. And President Obama wanted to be Nixon to China, wanted a big sweeping deal. The Metternich of MSNBC, Ben Rhodes, explained it all in books that nobody has read, that they had this grand vision, but they were dummies and it didn't work. And Iran got refunded by Obama, and then they got refunded again by Biden, and they send that money out to their proxies and they kill Jews. And it's astonishing to me that Jake Sullivan gave this press conference and tried to say, oh, you know, it's ironic, isn't it, that they're complaining about our interfering in their politics when all they do is interfere in ours. Well, yesterday, in that briefing, the White House said Israel lacks coherent and sustainable strategy in Gaza. It does not. Joe Biden warned Netanyahu in a call yesterday that an assault on Rafah would be a mistake. It isn't. It's actually a necessity, as I will explain later today in the Washington Post piece. President Biden rules out support for a major Rafah op. They don't really care. They really don't care. They're going into Rafah. They're not going to leave the tunnel system untouched. They're not going to not reestablish the Philadelphia corridor, which runs between Egypt and Gaza. And they're going to get Sinwar and his brother in DF. All right. The number is 1, 2, and 3. I'm not sure if DF is ahead. I think he is of Sinwar. And then baby brother Sinwar is also on the wanted list. Yesterday, the IDF killed 40 terrorists in Shifa Hospital, including a senior commander, their head of intelligence. There's a Wall Street Journal editorial, Democrats Turn Against Israel, and it spends time reflecting on Chuck Schumer going after this. Now, I want to read you my Fox News column this morning. Morning Glory, what Masters of the Air teaches about Israel's war. I already told you the subtitle. All wars kill innocents. The people who start them bear the blame, not the people who finish them. I think we grabbed some Master of the Air B-roll for you for this. If you watch the 9-part series, Masters of the Air, on Apple Plus, my column begins, you may not notice that it does not spend much time on civilian casualties brought about by the unrelenting air war waged by the Allies against the Axis in World War II. The series was produced by Gary Getzman, Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg, and you'll be satisfied at the conclusion of the episodes, which are based on the bestseller of the same name by Donald Miller, Masters of the Air. The first few episodes are not for the faint of heart, but neither were any Army Air Corps bombing missions over Europe in World War II. There are moments in the course of the series when the viewer glimpses the utter devastation of the bombing of first France and then Germany. The Wehrmacht troops and the German civilians were seen repeatedly referring to downed American airmen as, quote, terror bombers. And no doubt the German civilians of 1943 to 1945 thought of the Army Air Corps and the Royal Air Force in just those terms because precision munitions had not been invented and the dumping of, quote, dumb bombs was effective only in part, even with technology advances in our bombers' sights. The people of the United States, though, do not worry about the hardships visited upon, quote, innocent Germans. Had Joseph Goebbels put out newsreels featuring Hermann Göring complaining about the devastation of civilian neighborhoods in Berlin brought about by Allied bombers, such propaganda would have elicited first enormous scorn and then calls for doubling down on the tonnage of bombs dropped. Millions of Germans, millions, were killed or injured because of the war begun by Hitler. The same is true of Japanese civilians killed by the Allied bombings of the Japanese home islands. The rulers of Imperial Japan brought that upon themselves. When the United States joined in the international effort to destroy ISIS, which culminated in the Battle of Mosul, which took 9 months, from October of 2016 through July of 2017, thousands of innocent Iraqis were killed in that battle, which included, of course, American airstrikes. Again, that terror group had to be destroyed. The inevitable byproduct of war in any urban setting is the death and wounding of civilians. And as with the German, Italian, and Japanese aggressors of World War II, ISIS began the war, which ended in the destruction of much of Mosul. Now the battlefield is the Gaza Strip, specifically the city of Rafah. However intense pressure is being brought to bear on Israel's defense forces, the IDF, to limit or even halt their offensive as a result of reports of casualties in Gaza put out by Hamas. Neither Israel nor any third party has anything like an exact figure of civilians killed or wounded in the war of Gaza. We cannot believe the Hamas numbers. What we do know is that Israel has no choice but to prosecute the war in Gaza until Hamas is destroyed, its senior leadership dead or fled, and a semblance of security returned to the people of Israel. The mask came off Hamas on October the 7th. For 17 years, Israel pursued a policy of coexistence with the terror organization that controlled everything in the Gaza Strip. With the Israeli government after government counting on the evolution of Hamas into a governing authoritarian regime, but not one devoted to massacring Jews. Now we know that Hamas, whatever else it does or says, is a death cult. And if allowed to remain in Gaza in any significant size and with its underground fortress intact, it will be a matter of time until Hamas unleashes another wave of horrific barbarism. That's why Monday's statement by National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan warning Israel against a major operation in Rafah makes no sense. Sullivan spoke of alternatives to such an operation, but did not detail what those alternatives were. We have to suspect that Sullivan knows there is no alternative to the brutal tunnel battles ahead, unless Sinwar and his fellow Hamas leaders arrange for their evacuation to their paymaster's home in Iran. The reliable estimates of Hamas terrorists who are cornered in Rafah and in the war ends of tunnels built over a decade and a half is 10,000 or more. Israel must absolutely enter and subdue all of Rafah, must absolutely map and destroy the underground fortress, and must retake the Philadelphia corridor between Gaza and Egypt to prevent the reconstruction of tunnels used to smuggle the mind-boggling amount of weaponry that Hamas amassed in Gaza since Israel withdrew from the Strip in 2005. There is no alternative for Israel unless it wants to wait for another massacre. Enormous majorities of Israelis want the war in Gaza prosecuted until the defeat of Hamas is complete. When first President Joe Biden, and that was in his State of the Union, and then Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on the floor of the Senate, attacked Israel over the past 2 weeks, they did so for their own selfish domestic political reason. The president's abysmal approval ratings and Schumer's desire to remain the leader of the Senate Democrats both required this rhetorical blast at Israel and its Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in order to satisfy the left edge of the Democratic coalition. These rhetorical attacks were gift to the Hamas terrorists. The IDF does not welcome civilian casualties in Gaza any more than the American pilots and crews wanted their bombs hit other than their intended target. Certainly, Israel is not approving anything approaching the Tokyo firebombing of March 1945, where 100,000 civilians were believed to have perished. The war in Gaza must, however, be won by Israel, and the only reason there is a war at all is because of Hamas. Only the end of Hamas in Gaza, which means a ground operation in Rafah, will bring peace to that devastated region. What President Biden and Senator Schumer should be doing is standing resolutely behind our ally every day, all day long. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Come right back. Well, I spent 3 hours this morning, Martha, doing nothing but the story of Bloodbath and Howie's interview, because the former president is a ratings draw and people want to talk about it. Carl is being generous and calling it over the top. It's a lie to actually suggest that the former president was calling for physical violence. He wasn't. And I'm glad you played both the beginning and the end of that, because it's clearly, I mean, there isn't any doubt here. There would be no doubt in any objective reading. He was talking about what would happen to the automobile industry in America if the Chinese funded and Mexican constructed EVs were allowed into the country without tariffs. I don't happen to agree with him on the policy, but I do agree this was completely taken out of context because it wasn't about journalism. It was about super serving a hardcore audience with what they wanted to hear, that Donald Trump is a tyrant who has blood on his hands and more to come. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by David M. Drucker of The Dispatch. David, I talked to Martha yesterday about that bloodbath group of comments. What did you make of that whole controversy? I just think it indicted the media again as being in the bag for Joe Biden.
Well, look, Hugh, I will say that when I heard the president's, I found it very confusing, right? And I will tell you, often when Donald Trump says things, I don't know what to make of them. I'm not sure exactly what he's saying. So what I've learned to do over the years, and this is what are we on 9 years running almost here in June, is take a breath and say nothing and try and figure out exactly what he means, because sometimes his remarks are taken out of context, and maybe deliberately, maybe not, but they're taken out of context. Other times they're not taken out of context. Look, I've interviewed the former president a couple of times, and he'll tell me point blank, no, that's exactly what I meant. In fact, yeah, that's my opinion. That's what I think. At other times he'll say that he was taken out of context and, you know, they're just coming after me because they're biased and, you know, all the other things he says. And so when I saw this, it struck me, given his comments over the years, that he, first of all, it wasn't that he was calling for violence. If you took the remarks that way, it's that he said there would be, if you took them that way. It struck me that that was possible. It also struck me possible that he was referring, you know, to his comments on the economy and what was going to happen economically in the United States if he wasn't elected.
But for the people living in a cave, let's play the entire minute five, cut number seven, Donald Trump in Ohio on Saturday.
Mexico has taken, over a period of 30 years, 34% of the automobile manufacturing business in our country. Think of it, went to Mexico. China now is building a couple of massive plants where they're going to build the cars in Mexico and think that they're going to sell those cars into the United States with no tax at the border. Let me tell you something to China. If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands the way I deal, those big monster car manufacturing plants that you're building in Mexico right now, and you think you're going to get that, you're going to not hire Americans, and you're going to sell the cars to us now, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it. But they're not going to sell those cars. They're building massive factories. A friend
of mine.
All right,
so David Drucker, we're talking about cars. We're talking about China. If I'm not elected, it's going to be a bloodbath. We're talking about cars. He's talking about cars.
Listen, Hugh, I'm not disputing you. What I am telling you is how I approach this as a journalist in trying to be accurate and fair, but also not just make wild assumptions that the man doesn't mean what he might mean, as he's told me before. No, that's exactly what I meant. And I thought that the comments were kind of confusing, but I am not disputing your account or saying I disagree with it. I'm saying that was my initial reaction. Look, I will also say that I think Trump often likes to use particular language so that journalists will get spun up about the worst of what he means. And then he and his supporters can say, well, obviously I meant something else, and it's plausible and maybe accurate. And then he gets to, with a wink and a nod to his supporters, use language that excites them. He gets the media spun up against him, as it appears to so many of his supporters. And that keeps his supporters tied to him in a particular way that other politicians don't experience. And I think he does that quite a bit.
That's true, David. I've interviewed him dozens of times. And he's the best interview in America because he does that. I can speak Trump fluently. You can speak Trump fluently. But the media chooses not to speak Trump fluently when they should. My only problem is if there's a French phrase in a novel and you don't understand it, look it up. And I heard so many, he's calling for another January. It was nonsense, absolute nonsense.
Well, look, fair enough. What I try to do as a journalist is not spend too much time critiquing my competitors, but just do a better job. So, listen, I understand why so many Republicans have issues with the media. It's, you know, one of the reasons I got into journalism over 20 years ago is to try and do things a little bit differently. You know, people that are new to politics may not be aware that Republicans have had similar complaints about political reporting going back long before Trump.
To Teddy White, the making of the president in 1960. I really do think it starts with Teddy White, the making of the president in 1960. David Drucker, always good to see you. David M. Drucker on X and over at The Dispatch, chief political correspondent for The Dispatch.
Mrs. Jackson? So my biggest concern is that your view has the First Amendment hamstringing the government in significant ways in the most important time periods. I mean, what would you have the government do? I've heard you say a couple times that the government can post its own speech, but in my hypothetical, you know, kids, this is not safe, don't do it, is not going to get it done. And so I guess some might say that the government actually has a duty to take steps to protect the citizens of this country.
Oh, Byron York, you and I are out of a job. Justice Jackson just does not want us to have the First Amendment anymore. What do you think about that, Byron?
It's the classic some might say argument.
Yes.
Well, you know, the first words, I think, of the First Amendment are Congress shall make no law. So,
Lady, you are correct.
It's actually hamstringing the government right there.
Yep, and it does it a lot, actually, in the Bill of Rights. That was the whole deal, hamstring the government.
Yes, it was a group of restrictions on what the government can't do. And one of the things the government can't do is engage in the kind of censorship that's at the heart of this case. And this is actually a really interesting argument from Justice Jackson in the sense that this is kind of a classic liberal versus conservative view of the living Constitution, the First Amendment. You know, Congress, you know, the government should be able to do this, and they should be able to stop all this terrible stuff you see on social media. So why can't the government just step in and censor it? And others saying, no, there's actual freedom of speech involved here.
You know, it takes three classes to teach the state action doctrine when I teach con law every other year at Chapman, and 3 hours, actually it's more like 4 hours total, to teach state action doctrine. So we're not going to get to it here. I just thought Justice Brown Jackson's phrasing was a bit of an alarm bell in the night. An alarm bell in the night for Joe Biden is in the Financial Times, Byron. This battleground election state is booming, but Biden is not getting credit. That's because it turns out when you read the Financial Times article, Georgia isn't booming. It's getting very expensive.
You know, if you look at the Real Clear Politics average of polls, you'll see that Georgia, along with Arizona and a couple more, one of the states in which Donald Trump is leading Joe Biden by more than 5 points. I think it's 5.7 percentage points in Georgia. So you read this article in the FT, and it's about, gosh, you know, the economy's doing so well. It's another one of these, the economy's doing so great, why aren't people happier, and why don't they support Joe Biden more? But then you go down it. First of all, you know, inflation is a cumulative thing. Okay, so if prices went up 9% for a while, and then they slowed to 6%, and then they slowed to 3%, you add all of that stuff together, and you're seeing Republicans a lot talking about inflation having been 20%, that is the cumulative effect of inflation since Joe Biden became president. And you see that in the FT story. I'll read you one paragraph. Inflation in housing has been stunning. This is in Clayton County, Georgia. It's where Hartsfield Airport is. So you know, house yep. prices in the county rose by 30% in the 20 years before the pandemic. In the 2 years after, they leapt by 50%.
Wow.
So, I mean, if you were on the edge of being able to buy a home before this inflation happened, you can just forget about it now. And
you know, Lawrence Summers did a big piece, Byron, on the cost of borrowing not actually showing up in the inflation data. And that goes to buying a home, and it goes to borrowing to buy a car, or borrowing to, you know, buy groceries. The cost of borrowing has gone through the ceiling.
Yeah. And if you look at what is the money that is actually coming into this area, as far as the federal government, it is all ideologically based money. Joe Biden's, and I'm reading from FT, Joe Biden's ambition is to fix the problems, consumer spending, by building the economy from the middle out and the bottom up. And then you look at the spending that he's touting. There's going to be $5 billion spent on an electric vehicle battery plant, and another $2.3 billion spent on a solar panel manufacturing factory. So the Inflation Reduction Act has poured a certain amount of ideological spending on Georgia, and that the effects of that kind of money are not usually felt.
I got asked by Martha McCollum yesterday, Byron, you know, what's going to drive this election. I have a handy acronym, ABCDEI, which is appeasement, the border, crime, diversity, environmental extremism, and inflation. And I could just say DEI at the end, but that I want to make sure I put inflation in. I think this is a frozen election. I don't really now. Ohio isn't frozen. The Senate election day is very interesting to me, but I think it's frozen. I think everyone's made up their mind already, and I can't see anything changing. Do you?
What I always say is that, you know, barring an act of God, I mean, obviously things can change, but I agree with you about. That the voters' positions just seem pretty set right now. Their feelings about Donald Trump seem pretty set right now. Their feelings about Joe Biden seem set right now. So, I don't disagree with what you're saying. I just add a little, barring an act of God.
There is always that chance. You know, 9/11s happen, stock market collapses happen, panics happen, banks fall, all sorts of, and China could go down the tube or launch an invasion of Taiwan. All sorts of things can happen, but all other things being equal, assuming no October surprise, I just think it's not much room to move. Let me ask you, Byron, I've got two columns up today, one at Fox News on the need to go into Rafah and one at the Washington Post on the need to go into Rafah. And I wrote them both at different times. They just appeared on the same day. And yesterday, Joe Biden says, don't go into Rafah. And I just can't even believe, and I remind people in the Washington Post, Robert Gates told us, warned us. He'd been wrong for 40 years. He did that 10 years ago. He's now wrong for 50 years. If Joe Biden says, don't go into Rafah, then the Israelis ought to go into Rafah yesterday.
Yeah, I do. I really don't have a lot of strategic advice for Israel on this. But I do keep the Robert Gates thing in mind. In Gates' memoir, he wrote that Joe Biden, who for years I think was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which made him feel that he had conducted foreign relations,
that Biden had been wrong about every major foreign policy and national security question for four decades. And so you're right, it's now five decades. And I think Biden has not gotten any better. Joe Scarborough may be right. This may be the best Biden ever, but that's the problem.
Joe came up yesterday as well. Joe was beating up on people who thought bloodbath was nonsense. I reminded everyone that back in 2016, Joe used to beat up on me in conversations when President Trump would call into Mika and Joe's show, and they would just love on each other. Let me ask you this, Byron. American Jews voted for Al Gore 79%. They voted for, and then it has steadily decreased over 20 years. So they voted for Al Gore, 79% of American Jews, to 68% of American Jews for Joe Biden. That's because Trump was very good for Israel. What do you think it's going to be, if you had to take a guess, in 2024, from 68, is it going to go up, down, or stay the same?
Well, first of all, as far as what motivates American Jews to vote, I would guess that it's as diverse a series of set of issues, including the economy, crime, national security, et cetera, as anybody else. On the other hand, there's an actual war involving Israel going on right now. And Biden's position has been, you know, it's been very unpopular with a lot of Democrats. I mean, that's why we've seen in some states, not all, but in some states, this uncommitted vote, which is significant enough for Biden to be worried about it. So my guess is that this year, when the Democratic Party has aligned itself with so much of this anti-Israel rhetoric, I got to see that number going down a bit.
I do, too. And I think it's not even the Israel so much as it is the anti-Semitism in America that has gone unremarked upon by the president in the State of the Union. Every Jewish kid on major campuses has felt this. And they go home and they talk to their mom and dad about it. And everybody knows Joe Biden is quiet about this, Byron. Do you think he's ever going to speak up?
No, I don't think so. It's just, I mean, it's, you know, this was going on long before October 7th. I mean, there was a very pro-Palestinian, anti-Israeli part of the Democratic Party. And it basically got to sort of coexist with the rest of the party, in part because of some of the stability that Donald Trump actually brought to the area. So, you know, when the region is not on fire, it's just not as big a deal rhetorically inside the United States.
And when realignments occur, they occur slowly, 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 and then all at once. And I think we have a realignment among American Jewry, but we will see, and among friends of Israel who are not Jewish. Thank you, Byron York. Follow him on X at Byron York and on Fox News and at the Washington Examiner. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned. Folks, so many people I know are disheartened that our country seems to have forgotten the importance of citizenship. And they wonder how a strong sense of citizenship might be revived. That's why my friends at Hillsdale College have produced a free online course on the topic, American Citizenship and Its Decline. Taught by historian Victor Davis Hanson, the course traces the history of citizenship and explains how it is undermined in America today by open borders, by identity politics, by the administrative state, and by globalization. Americans taking the course will gain a deeper insight about the connection between citizenship and freedom, an insight they can share with family members, friends, and neighbors. Hillsdale's free online courses are an important component of Hillsdale's mission to reach and teach increasing millions of people on behalf of liberty and the American way of life. So sign up today for Hillsdale's free online course, American Citizenship and Its Decline, by visiting hughforhillsdale.com. That's H-U-G-H-F-O-R, Hillsdale.com, hughforhillsdale.com. Start your free course today at hughforhillsdale.com.
How lucky can one guy be? I kissed her and she kissed me. Like the fella once said, ain't that a kick in the head?
Welcome back, America. You might be wondering why I'm featuring Dean Martin. And it's because Dean Martin is featured in this book, 2054, the brand new novel by Admiral James Stavridis, retired United States Navy, Elliot Ackerman, another bestseller on their hands. Good morning, Admiral. Are you the guy that insisted on the Dean Martin homage there?
Oh, you and I are just of that generation to remember Dean Martin. I don't think we knew him personally, but Yeah, he and Frank Sinatra have always been part of my playlist.
Well, I'm trying to think, if I was going to go back 100 years in time, this book is set in 2054, and the people who like Dean Martin are going back 100 years, we would be playing some ragtime right now. I'm not a ragtime, but I'll bet you Dean Martin and the Rat Pack are still around by 2054. I'm not sure the world would be if we achieved the singularity. Now, Admiral, I'm enjoying this greatly, and I'm going to make a couple of points. I'm going to have you and Elliot back to talk about the book at length. How did it do in its first week?
We hit number 50, roughly, on the combined Amazon fiction, nonfiction list. Number one political thriller, number one military thriller. You know, to hit 50 out of 32 million books on Amazon is pretty good. This will be our push week. Book just came out 6 days ago. So I'm hoping to see it pop on some of the national bestseller lists, as well as already being an Amazon bestseller.
Well, I'm telling you, Admiral, you got to switch out the book behind you. You've got your old book on the bookstand behind you. So when we cut to the full thing, we see your old book, and I'm holding up the new one. So people should look at 2054. One thing I want to bring up, we got tossed out of Niger this week. In this book, Nigeria is a client state of China. Do you think that Niger is a client state of China and similar to what happened here, happened there?
Absolutely. And one of the things that is continuously bubbling in 2054 is the rise of a new set of major geopolitical actors from 2034, the first book, of course, see U.S., China, India playing a prominent role. In this book, you see Nigeria, Brazil, Japan playing very prominent roles mid-century.
And that is why I think it's very hard to go out this far and be accurate, but by predicting the singularity, would you explain the singularity? Because if I do it, it'll be botched.
I wish I had invented and patented the term, but that credit remains to Ray Kurzweil, a futurist who 20 years ago talked about something called the singularity. In essence, Hugh, it is everything coming together, hence the term singular. It brings together not only the biological, our human form, our brains, our physiology, all of that merges in the singularity with computer chips, with animated devices that move us. It's the merge of biology, microengineering, technology, artificial intelligence all come together in ways that are, let's face it, at this point, kind of unpredictable. The far end of this would be a situation in which you could take Hugh Hewitt, your brain, your memories, your emotions, your preferences, your personality, and upload it onto a computer chip, which would achieve a form of immortality. We are right at the edge of that mid-century in 2054.
And I think Ray Kurzweil is going to enjoy this book. Is he a friend of yours, by the way? Because he's still out there kicking around. I haven't seen him write anything recently, but it's an interesting homage to him in this book. And so I don't know.
Yeah, he is a character in the book. I don't know him personally. We're awaiting his response. Hopefully it'll be a positive one.
Well, I think if you get him to mention 2054, that's a guarantee of a bestseller. But it is a great read, and I'll talk more about Elliot Ackerman a little bit later. You know, Admiral, there was an essay by Charles Krautheimer before he died that got reproduced in his memoir that we haven't heard from civilizations in the far outer space because eventually they reach the technological tipping point you're talking about and they destroy themselves. What do you think about that?
Let's hope it's not true. B, since the universe is by definition infinite, there have to be other civilizations, other forms of life. Are there other carbon-based, highly similar forms to us? I think there have to be, again, if you accept the proposition that the universe is infinite. The idea of hitting a point where we simply destroy ourselves again and again and again in the universe is quite discouraging, let's face it. I don't think that's what happens. And the characters in our novel, 2054, really carry this story. It's a very human story of colliding with this new technology in ways that are shaping the present.
Yeah, I am reading two books in parallel, 2054 and the three-body problem, which was recommended by John Podhoretz, which is going to be a Netflix thing. And in the three-body problem, they review our probes that we sent out in the 70s when you and I were young men, and three out of four of them have gone dark, right? They've run out of gas. They run out of energy. So whenever some solar system picks it up, they're going to look at that and say, these people didn't even know how to power a satellite. We're not going to talk to them. I'm not really worried about it. They're out there somewhere, but these four probes keep going. Those were big deals. When we launched, I think it's Voyager 1, Voyager 2. I can't remember what the other two were called. We launched four of them in the 70s, and only one of them is working. What do you think the people up in space are going to think about us?
I think they see us as pretty primitive at this point, and we shouldn't worry about that. What we ought to worry about are our challenges here on Earth, so we can get to the point where we can be respectably presented to galactic civilization. I think Carl Sagan, somebody you and I both remember, had that idea that we needed to move forward to that point. We're clearly not there yet, but I remain cautiously optimistic. And 2054 is a cautiously optimistic book.
Billions and billions of stars. Yeah, you and I are the age of Carl Sagan on PBS. Let me go to the current here and the now with a couple of issues, Admiral. West Point announced yesterday that they are removing duty, honor, country from their mission statement. It will remain the motto of West Point. I can't tell you how much I think this is a bad idea, but what do you think?
Well, as you know, I'm a Naval Academy graduate, so anything that causes confusion and alarm to West Point, its graduates, is totally fine by me. I think I haven't followed the issue closely, but I have friends on both sides of it. I've seen snippets from retired flag officer generals who say, hey, it's not a big deal. It's still the motto. It's not in the mission statement. And then I have other West Point contemporaries who are just furious about it. Looks like a lot of internal conflict at West Point. Hey, if it were me, I would not touch duty, honor, country. I mean, you can't throw a stone at West Point without hitting those words. They're absolutely embedded in every cadet and every West Point grad. They're iconic. Why would you want to fool around with that?
For the same reason that someone at the VA thought it was a good idea to take down all the pictures of the sailor kissing the girl on VJ Day. I think it was VJ Day. Maybe it was VE Day. I cannot believe that. And, of course, neither could the Secretary of the Veterans Administration, who ordered it reversed. But changing longstanding archetypes and motives and slogan, it's just not good business.
Yeah, the Naval Academy motto is from knowledge, see power. I don't think we're going to change that. On the other hand, it doesn't have the same ring as duty, honor, country. So I stand on don't change a thing up there, West Point. But if you guys all want to argue about it and get distracted so we win the next Army-Navy game, go for it.
That's right. Now, every other ship in the Navy has a slogan, right? Or at least the aircraft carriers do. Do you remember each of your slogans from your ships, Admiral?
Oh, 100%. My first ship was a destroyer, the Hewitt. It was be just and fear not, which I think is a wonderful,
terrific phrase.
USS Valley Forge, the first cruiser I served on, was because of the Valley Forge and George Washington, it was first in war, first in peace. I could go on and on. I've been on a lot of ships, Hugh. We don't have time for all of them. But every Navy ship has a motto, and it is very important to that ship. I'll close with this one. My wife is the sponsor of a beautiful new destroyer, brand new, DDG 113, the USS John Finn. It's named after a Medal of Honor winner. You saw him in the movie Pearl Harbor. He's the chief petty officer who grabs a bunch of guys, and they get a machine gun, and they shoot down a Japanese Zero. He received 62 wounds, shrapnel wounds in his body. The motto of that ship is stand and fight.
Well, that's a great motto. The sponsor society is a great thing. I want to close by saying about Gaza, Admiral, your quick take. White House says Israel lacks coherent and sustainable strategy in Gaza. The president advised the prime minister not to go into Rafah. I think that's terrible advice because I don't think you can allow Hamas to remain, and I don't think you can get him out When you were the Supreme Allied Commander, there was an air war in Serbia, if I am not mistaken. That's different from Rafa. There was no tunnel system in Serbia. Am I right about that?
You are, and the military center of gravity is actually not Hamas. That's a legitimate target of war to destroy that organization, and they should do it. The center of gravity, that about which all else revolves, is the tunnel complex. It's got to be decommissioned, destroyed, flooded, exploded, sealed. It'll be different. You're showing some video now. The Israelis are going to have to keep going until they completely destroy that tunnel complex. On the other hand, yes, they ought to do everything they can to minimize civilian casualties. And this is why, Hugh, I think it's a good thing for the aid to come in by sea and by land, frankly, up in the north. Then you pull that civilian population out of Rafah, kind of clear the field. That's when the Israelis can go in and decommission the remnants of that tunnel system in the south. They're already doing it in the north.
And they've got to reestablish the Philadelphia corridor to separate the ability of tunnels to be dug from Gaza into Sinai. Admiral James Stavridis, congratulations on 2054. I look forward to talking to you about it at length when Elliot is back with you. 2054 in bookstores now. Order it from Amazon. Get it from Barnes & Noble. It's in every airport that I went through this weekend, and I got my copy 2 days ago, and I'm blowing through it. So 2054 is just absolutely a wonderful read. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm coming right back. It is Ohio voting day. Hey, Buckeyes, get out and vote. You got to pick Matt Dolan or Frank LaRose or Bernie Marino. That's alphabetical order. I'm a neutral in this one. It's tight. It's very tight. Could be a one-vote election. Could be one of those. Don't forget to vote in Ohio. I'll be right back. I'm joined by Brett Baer, host of Special Report. Brett, welcome. Yesterday, I was on with Martha McCollum mid-afternoon. I said, I can't believe we're doing this. Again, this is not a story, but it's still a story. How did you handle it on Special Report?
Well, I talked to Britt Hume about it, who kind of said, listen, the former president says a lot of things that raise eyebrows, a lot of things that sometimes are out of whack. Some things, it seems like, that are designed to make the left's heads explode. But this was a thing that, in context, seemed like it was pretty cut and dry. I mean, when you have Snopes.com, clarifying that he was talking about the automobile industry and the automobile productivity in that industry, I think it's pretty amazing to see how far some places went with it. Now, that's not to say the former president is not worth some criticism about how he phrases things and how he talks about things sometimes. But this one seemed like it was pretty easy.
Yeah, I was. I got to share the stage with Karl Rove, more importantly, Karl's whiteboard. And Karl pointed out this is the one where you actually can't tag him on this. He just left off one word, and you speak Trump and I speak Trump. He said it'll be a bloodbath four, and then he moved on. He always leaves off the object of the sentence. It'll be a bloodbath for American automobile workers is what he meant to say, but he didn't finish it. I digress. I'm not going to do any more on that because it's silly. Brett, I remind people all the time, you started at the Pentagon. There is my objective question. Do you ever remember the United States telling an ally how to wage a war in the level of detail that Joe Biden allegedly told Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday not to go into Rafah when you were at the Pentagon?
No, never. And it would not be welcome for any other country to tell the U.S. how to wage a war, nor would we as a country listen to any other country about how to wage a war. So I agree. This is a unique scenario. And I think that the politics around it are also fascinating and obviously factor in to some of the decisions the White House is making.
Well, it goes back to, and I mentioned in a Washington Post column today, Robert Gates said Joe Biden's been wrong about everything for 40 years on national security 10 years ago. Since then, we've had Afghanistan, Putin going into Ukraine a second time, and now we've got the Gaza war. I think he's just wrong, Brett. I don't know how you can leave Hamas standing. Has anyone explained to you what Jake Sullivan meant? In fact, I want to play the tape for you so you can comment on it. Here's Jake Sullivan at the White House podium yesterday, cut number 5.
Well, first of all, inherent in the question is a kind of an interesting irony, which is you have the prime minister speaking on American television about his concerns about Americans interfering in Israeli politics. And then your question is, should Americans be speaking into Israeli politics, which, in fact, we don't do nearly as much as they speak into ours.
OK, that's an objective statement. We can evaluate that. Brett, do you agree with Jake Sullivan that they do it more than we do it to them?
No. I mean, there are a couple instances where I think the Obama people felt that Netanyahu was purposely doing speeches and big events during that time, and they felt that there was some sort of effort to rally, you know, especially Jews in America, you know, against the policy maybe the Obama administration was doing. I think that there's some hangover from that time, but as far as the amount of interaction, no. I mean, no.
No. We don't do that. They don't do that. The Iran speech by Netanyahu to the joint session of Congress was an exception to the rule, but that was about a deal that dealt directly with Iran. Now they're telling Israel how to wage war in Rafah. He also said there are alternatives. Jake Sullivan said there are alternatives to a ground invasion of Rafah. Do you have any idea what those are, Brett? Because I am unaware of them.
I don't. I don't know that. And, you know, you have to find these folks. You have to get to them, you know, hidden in places inside that population. And, you know, one of the things Israel's trying to do is get some of the civilians out of that area prior to going in. You know, this is Hamas's deal, and why the onus is not on Hamas is kind of lost in some of the conversation here. Why, you know, Hamas holding people in Gaza as human shields, why is that not the onus here, not Israel going after them?
No one should be indifferent, and you aren't and I'm not, to civilian casualties. I also note, because I just finished watching Masters of the Air, and I don't know if you've had the chance to watch that yet, Brett. It's about the Army Air Corps and missions over Europe. We did not worry about civilians in the—I mean, we tried not to hit civilians, but we didn't worry if the bombs went awry. And we did not send aid into Germany in the spring of 1945 because they were starving. It just seems to me to be Israel's going above and beyond any standard that the United States military has ever followed. Do you agree or disagree with that?
We were taking out al-Qaeda terrorists. I was in Afghanistan, and there were calls for drone attacks on places where we thought big targets were. There were decisions made that took out the wrong targets. There were efforts made to take out high-value targets where other people clearly were going to get killed, and that decision was made. And despite, you know, any negative publicity around it, that was the mission, to take out those high-value targets. No one said stop to the U.S.
Most recently, during the collapse in Afghanistan, after the Abbey Gate explosion, we took out an alleged participant in the bombing that was innocent and his family. And again, that goes down to the cost of war. I'm not sure that it wasn't reckless what they did. But I want to bring to your attention something by Seth Mandel, Israel's critics in the Fauda problem, which I've been waiting for someone to say. Have you watched Fauda, Brett?
I have not.
Well, it makes every Israeli spy and member of Mossad and Shin Bet out to be Superman. And what Seth writes is that the CSI problem, jurors wanting DNA evidence, is now the Israeli problem. Everyone thinks they're superheroes. They're not. I mean, they got to wage war the old-fashioned way. It's terrible. It's awful. And there's no way to end this until they go into Rafah. And if you disagree with me, feel fine. But I just don't see what Jake Sullivan is talking about here.
Oh, I think that they have they're making a case. They're saying to, you know, Palestinian supporters that we hear you and we're going to pressure. And they want that message out for the left part of the Democratic Party. I just don't think the Israelis are listening. That said, I do think Bibi Netanyahu is in a precarious place politically inside Israel, and his future depends on how all of this goes, and frankly, if after it, he can make some big deal with Saudi Arabia or others.
You know, Israeli leaders do not survive surprise. They may linger, but they don't survive national security surprises. So he might be a first. Brett, thank you as always. Great to talk to you. Remember, whenever you're watching Brett on Special Report, he's actually a Pentagon reporter, and those are the best reporters in Washington, D.C. They actually have to know things, and Brett knows things. That's why you should be watching Special Report every night. When I come back, I'm going to go back over what we covered with Martha McCollum yesterday, and I've got Tim Carney coming up. I've got Rob Portman at the bottom of the hour. Tim Carney coming up with his brand new book. We got lots ahead. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, except over to Alliance Defending Freedom banner at the top of HughHewitt.com. Alliance Defending Freedom has got a Supreme Court argument next week. They win, typically, at the Supreme Court. They've won 15 times in the last two decades, 15 times. It takes about $1 million to win one of those cases. I just urge you, whether it's $5, $50, $500, Alliance Defending Freedom, it's completely tax deductible. They preserve your rights in a court, at least part of which is hostile to your First Amendment rights to free speech and the free exercise of your faith. So please support Alliance Defending Freedom. The banner is at HughHewitt.com. At the top, you cannot miss it. Stay tuned.
Walk across a ghostly bridge to a crumbling promised land. If Jesus came from Mississippi, if tears began to rise, I guess I'll start at the beginning. It's a world of strange.
Welcome back, America. That music is the theme song to Look Through the Chaos, brand new podcast by John Campbell and our own Dwayne Patterson, which you can get wherever you get your podcasts. What is the name of that song again?
The World of Strange Design by Roseanne Cash.
And you picked that.
I did pick that. Because
John
I
Campbell
actually
did
do
not
know
pick
some music.
That.
No, John Campbell did not pick that.
Why did you pick that for Look Through the Chaos podcast?
For lots of reasons. The lyrical content talks a lot about a lot of chaos that you see everywhere and what's behind it. The music has a very ominous overall tone and mood to it.
You've got an ominous tone.
Well, I do at times.
Yeah, I'm telling you, Mr. Ominous right there.
Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is MyPhDWeightLoss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
Sure tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is. But we don't... I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No.
You haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And that is a, and it's healthy, it's wise, it's productive.
864-644-1900.
That's
864-644-1900.
Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. I have long prided myself on knowing my home state of Ohio's politics. Because I go way back in Ohio, back to John Glenn and Howard Metzenbaum being our senators. I'm joined by former Senator Rob Portman, who has endorsed Matt Dolan in today's Ohio primary. Good morning, Senator. Welcome back. Are you enjoying retirement from the Senate?
Good morning, Hugh. Yeah, it's nice not to be there, but I do miss you and doing the public policy stuff, but it's kind of a crazy time in Washington, so I'm happy to be home.
Well, it is a crazy time in Ohio. I don't ever recall a Senate race this close. Did you ever have a Senate race this close? You always won like double digits, and I'm not sure it's going to be Matt, Bernie, or Frank by 1, 2, or 3%, but it ain't going to be by double digits.
No, it's not. It's going to be tight. All the polls are showing that. It does look like it's between Bernie Moreno and Matt Dolan based on the four or five polls that I've seen this week. But yeah, it's certainly close. And the key is to get the right person in the Republican primary to win in the fall, because, as you know, Ohio, once again, is going to be one of those key states to determine whether we get the Senate majority or not for Republicans. And that makes a huge difference for the country.
Who can beat Sherrod Brown? This is the key. Is that why you endorse Matt Dolan?
I think he's the best candidate to win in November for sure. And by the way, the polling does show that. But $3 million from Chuck Schumer trying to help Bernie Moreno probably says it a lot more distinctly and definitively. So, you know, the Democrats have chosen who they would like to win the primary because they think that person will be easier to beat in the fall.
Oh, that's what Adam Schiff did in California. He pumped millions of dollars into Steve Garvey's account to knock off I can't remember Katie Porter's name, and she was mad. Yeah. So is that going on in Ohio?
Yeah, the Democrats have taken out, they say, over $3 million now in the last week or so of ads, and the ads are intended to help Bernie Moreno, who's a good guy, I know him, but he will not be as strong against Sherrod Brown based on all the polling. And frankly, you know, the Democrats are trying to decide who our Republican candidate is, and they've done this in other states. Adam Schiff just did it in California. It's just wrong, and my hope is that the voters see through that.
So, Senator, what does it take to actually be effective in the Senate? People always said Rob Portman was a very effective senator from Ohio. John Glenn was as well. Howard Metzenbaum, not so much. And I can't remember, do you have the Glenn seat or did you have the Metzenbaum seat?
I think I have the Metzenbaum seat, not the Glenn seat.
Here's, exactly.
Here's the deal. You know, being conservative is important, representing Ohio. We're an increasingly red state. But getting things done to me is essential. So I think Matt Dolan is the guy who is the conservative with results. And I know that because I've seen his record in the State House. And he's campaigning on that basis, saying, you know, I'm going to get stuff done. Let me take the border, for example, Hugh. You and I have talked about this so many times. Not since 1986, as you know, has Congress taken any significant action to deal with the problems on the border. I mean, it's just outrageous. And everybody knows it's a terrible policy. There is a catastrophe going on at the border. I'd go beyond crisis. And yet neither side can figure out a way to get to yes, because it's frankly a pretty good political issue for both sides. You need someone who's going to roll up his sleeves, in the case of Matt Dolan, and jump into this thing and solve it. And I think that's what we're missing in politics today, is you've got a lot of people on the periphery, frankly, progressives as well as some Republicans on the right and on the left, who are happy to throw out the red meat and go on some great shows, excluding Hugh Hewitt's, which is heavily on policy, and talk about, you know, the politics of it, but aren't willing to figure out how to get to yes and how to figure out how to solve a problem. And Matt's done that. He put out the best budget I think Ohio's ever had. They say it's the most conservative budget ever. So he knows how to cut spending. He knows how to cut taxes. They put big tax cuts in under his leadership of the Ways and Means Committee. And, you know, he's got the right position, in my view, on foreign policy. You're a Reagan Republican, as I am, and you got to have peace through strength, not through allowing Putin, as an example, to have his way. So I think, and he's the only one talking that way. So I think he's got the best policy solutions, but also he's got the best approach to how you actually get stuff done for the people of Ohio.
I also got a full disclosure. Joan, his sister, is a friend of mine, and I've known Joan for a long time. She's very active in pro-life circles up in Cleveland. This is interesting to me as a political matter, Senator Portman, because it's always been Cleveland versus Cincinnati. You come from the south of the state. I come from the north of the state. But both Bernie Moreno and Matt Dolan are Clevelanders. So I really have no idea who's stronger down in Cincinnati between these two. What do you know?
Well, let's start with Cleveland, Hugh, because that's probably the best example. Matt has always run ahead of the Republican Party in Cuyahoga County, and that's partly because he's from there, partly because his style of politics, I think, is more acceptable to all those conservative independents. And you know him well from Warren, Ohio, where you're from, all the way up, you know, to Parma and other areas around Cleveland. So Matt will exceed expectations in the most populated part of the state, which is the northeast part of the state. Down here in Cincinnati, I don't know, frankly, how they're running. I would imagine both of them are running okay. You know, all three of them are from, of the candidates in the race are from the Northeast Ohio area. So I know Matt's gotten a great response down here. I was at two events with him last week. And, you know, people are looking for, in Southwest Ohio, it's kind of like it's a conservative area, but they want people who are going to achieve something of meaning for themselves and their family. It's an interesting area. I'd love to represent it in the House and in the Senate. As you said, I won my last race by 21 points, and partly that was on the strength of Southwest Ohio. I think they'll both do okay down here, but I think the key is that I think Matt will do extremely well in the more Democrat area of Cuyahoga County.
Now, Senator, I'm not sure if it's an open primary or not. I can't remember that. But what was your closest election, either for the House or the Senate? I mean, did you ever come within single digits?
No, I was fortunate. I was very fortunate. And my final candidate was former Governor Ted Strickland. And he just, you know, he was beating me in the first poll, and we won by 21 points. The other one I won by 18 points. In the House, I never won with less than 70% of the vote. So I just was very fortunate. And I thank the people of Ohio for that. So I didn't have to go through this kind of a tough primary. Actually, my first race was a primary. There were 10 of us in it, and I got something like 36% of the vote. But spread out among 10 people, that was enough.
There were a couple of debates in the Senate race. Did they matter, Senator Portman?
I think they matter. I'm glad we're having debates. I hope we'll have a debate at the presidential level this year. Because it was an opportunity to see what the candidates' positions were once pressed. Ukraine is an example. When pressed, I thought Matt had, the best answer, which is you can't let a dictator, really a tyrant like Putin, win here because of the consequences for American national security. As important as Ukraine is, this is about America, and it's about ensuring that we do not allow this to happen all over the world because our adversaries and our allies alike are watching. So I think the debates are good to flesh out some of those issues.
I talked to your successor yesterday, J.D. Vance, and he's a friend of mine, a friend of yours. J.D. is against aid for Ukraine. I am very in favor of aid for Ukraine. Do Bernie and Matt disagree on that?
Yes. Bernie has taken a strong position against aid to Ukraine. And again, there are differences of opinion on this. I get it. But you have to answer the question, what are you going to do with the consequence of this, which is not what some of the anti-Ukrainian people are saying, which is that somehow Putin will come to the bargaining table only if we back off. There's no evidence of that. And there's no record of that in terms of Vladimir Putin in particular, or historically. So I think you got to answer that question. And in my view, strong view, this is about America's national security interest. The countries that are all around Ukraine are members of NATO, as you know, and those countries, many of them, four of them, will now be on the border with Russia, and they're all arming up, and they're all requiring us to do more as an Article 5 under NATO requires, which is a mutual defense agreement. So we're going to end up getting, I think, much more involved if Putin wins and takes over Ukraine. A lot of human rights abuses, obviously, and a lot of war crimes, but also just the fact that American troops and equipment are going to have to be amassed on Fortress Europe, which will be that border now between countries like Poland, the Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and other Romania, other allies of ours in the region.
Now, I have no idea who's going to win tonight, and I don't think they may not even be able to call it tonight. We'll see. But I want to close with this. A lot of people do not know this, Senator, but the Ukrainian-American population in Ohio is not insignificant. Am I correct in that? I mean, you have to go to the Ukrainian churches, and you have to go to the Ukrainian neighborhoods, and you got to go to the Ukrainian state fairs if you're an elected official. And I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Yeah, I am. And it's a great community. They're patriots. They're joined also, Hugh, and I know you know this, by what's called the nationalities community, which is a larger group of people who come from places like the Baltics. I mentioned Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, they come from Poland, they come from the whole region because they all share something in common, which is they lived where their parents or grandparents did under communism, and they escaped to the United States for freedom. They view America as a beacon of hope and opportunity still, and it's a great patriotic community, and they feel obviously very strongly about this, not just as it relates to the specific country of Ukraine, but as it relates to the whole region, that this is a reversal of years and years and years of fighting to achieve freedom. And in 1991, finally, Ukraine was able to achieve that. By the way, in 1994, we made an agreement with Ukraine that we would protect their territorial integrity if they gave up nuclear weapons. That's one reason that we have an obligation here, but it's not the major reason. The major reason is it's because it's in our national security interest. And the money, as you know, seven out of every $10 is going to the United States, to American workers. It's not going to Ukraine in a sense. It's going to places like the Lima tank plant in Ohio to make Abrams M1 tanks so that they can have the ability to defend themselves.
Now, there you hear retail politics. If they know where the defense contractors are, they've obviously been in the game for a while. Let me close, Senator Portman, not only by reminding people get out and vote today, whether you're voting for Matt Dolan as Senator Portman will be or Bernie Moreno as Senator Vance will be, but no matter who you are, get out and vote. Senator, what are you doing now? I mean, you've been gone for 2 years. How are you? Like, I know you're riding your bike and all that stuff, but what do you do?
Yeah, I've been gone for not 2 years yet, but it's a year and a few months. And I started a center at the University of Cincinnati called the Portman Center for Policy Solutions. And it's a lot about these issues we talked about today. It's how do you solve policy problems today when you get so many forces pushing people out to the periphery and, again, encouraging them to throw out red meat but not to solve the problem? And I worry about that with regard to debt and deficit, certainly with regard to the border. certainly with regard to tax policy. As you know, I'm a big fan of tax cuts and tax reform. And so I have this policy group. We've got a bunch of students who are fellows. So we do seminars and so on. That's been interesting and fun. And then I'm on a couple of boards. The Bechtel Company, as you know well from California,
yep.
which is a great family, great company. That's where George Shultz was at one point, as you know, and Kath Weinberger. Also on the Proctor board. Also involved.
Well, that's a better commute.
Enterprise Institute.
The Proctor board is a much better commute than going out to Bechtel land. But good for you, Senator. Good to hear you're doing well, and good luck in getting out the vote today. Everyone should vote in Ohio. Go make your choice. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Stay tuned.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.